case for argument is Associates Financial Services versus the Bowman firm. Mr. Shockley.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Steve Shockley. I represent Associates Financial Services Company in these cross appeals. The District Court's order granting summary judgment against Associates on its malpractice claim against defendants, attorneys Glenn Bishan and his law firm Bowman Hines, was erroneous for two fundamental reasons. First, the District Court failed to apply the summary judgment standard in this circuit announced in the Harley-Davidson case, which required the District Court to view the evidence and the inferences from the evidence in the light most favorable to Associates. As a result, the District Court failed to consider substantial evidence that during the course of an attorney-client relationship with Associates, the attorneys encouraged, assisted, and asserted claims against their client, resulting in foreseeable harm to Associates. Second, the District Court failed to apply the law of proximate cause.
Before we move on, I wonder whether, as a matter of Indiana law, the ethical rules are enforceable in malpractice litigation.
Your Honor, the preamble to the Indiana Rules of Professional Conduct states that while the rules are not intended to create civil causes of action, reference to the rules as evidence of the standard of care is not prohibited. There are other bases on which the court, the District Court, should have concluded that there were violations.
The Supreme Court of Indiana in Sanders against Townsend said that the ethical rules should not be enforced in civil litigation, and that the court applies the rules through the disciplinary commission.
It's true that the court applies the rules through the disciplinary commission, Your Honor. As I read Sanders v. Townsend, it states that there is not a cause of action for constructive fraud solely as a result of a violation of the disciplinary rules.
It's true that that was a fraud case, but I don't see why the principle that these ethical rules are enforced through the disciplinary process differs between fraud cases and malpractice cases.
I understand, Your Honor. The rules of professional conduct are not the only evidence of the standard of care that was presented to the District Court. There was also the Supreme Court's decision in Bell v. Clark. There was also the opinions of experts, expert opinion being generally required in Indiana as evidence of the standard of care against which the attorney's conduct is to be measured.
So you're now, I mean, I didn't really understand your case very well, but so an example of what you regard as misconduct would be, so using information they had gotten while representing you to strengthen their position in disputing with you over these purchase claims? Is that the sort of thing that bothers you?
That is the sort of thing that bothers me, Your Honor. In fairness, the evidence was that the information that the attorneys used against their client, both by assisting others to bring claims against Associates and bring their own claims, was gathered through information it gained through a business transaction with their client. We don't claim, at least in the appellate court, that they used information gathered as a result of their representation.
Really?
That's true, yes.
Well, if they got the information from somewhere else, what is the problem?
Well, the problem is
they have a dual relationship with you. They're the purchaser of certain claims. So in that relationship, they're a purchaser, you're the seller, they don't like you, they think you've misbehaved. And then if they're representing you with regard to the claims, you didn't sell them where you just hired them as the lawyer, right? Isn't that it?
That's correct.
So if they just get information, if they don't, take the information they learned as your lawyer, but just obtain information elsewhere and use it against you in their sales relationship with you, what's the problem?
Well, there's a conflict of interest there.
I don't understand. Well, what is that?
Well,
apparently, when they represent you, your claims you have against various deadbeats and so on, they do good job. They do a acceptable job. And this dispute they have with you over the purchase claims, that's separate. Unless there's leakage between these two relationships, I don't see what the problem is.
Well, it's not simply it's not where they got the information, it's what they did with it, Your Honor. While representing this debt-buying company in which they were the owners...
Right, the law firm owned the company, did it not?
Well, all but a couple of the partners were all of the owners of,
exactly.
of the debt buying company.
And one might think when you entered into an arm's-length business relation, you certainly consented that they could represent their proprietary interests as the owners of these debts.
In enforcing those debts, certainly, Your Honor. In disputes with associates, however, they had a conflict of interest.
Well, that's what I don't understand, because as a purchaser, just because they're representing you in some other case doesn't mean you can screw them as the seller, right? And they don't have any recourse against you as the purchaser. That wouldn't make any sense, would it?
Well, Your Honor, they while representing associates... They're also representing their debt-buying company.
Yeah.
They're asserting claims against
associates. But you certainly agreed to that.
Well, we certainly were aware of it, but that raises nothing more than a question of comparative fault that, again, should be for the jury.
I don't understand that.
Any client can consent to its lawyer representing a client with an adverse interest, and if you sell these things to the law firm, you've consented.
Well,
your claim has to be that they did something beyond that, or there's no conceivable problem at all.
They did a great deal beyond that, Your Honor. The evidence of the breach of duty was substantial. It showed that
well, I don't know what the duty is. I don't understand that. Forget
it's the duty of loyalty that an attorney...
No. Their only duty to loyalty is to be loyal to you when they're representing you, not when they're in a buyer-seller relationship with you.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree.
Well, I think you're just completely wrong on that, because otherwise they're crippling themselves. You're saying that they don't have the ordinary rights of a purchaser because they represent you in separate matters.
We're not talking about the purchaser. We're talking about the law firm.
Yes, we are talking about the purchaser. The purchaser and the law firm are the same.
Well, they're different entities, Your Honor, and I'm not claiming that as purchaser they owe duties of care to associates. I'm saying that as the attorney, in an attorney-client relationship with associates.
Well, you're saying American, which was owned by Bowman, should have hired another law firm?
Yes, Your Honor.
If it had, what difference would it have made?
Well, but first of all, before they could bring claims...
What difference would it have made?
Would
another law firm have behaved differently from Bowman?
Well, we don't know, do we?
Well, why would they have behaved differently? Did Bowman do something unethical that another law firm wouldn't have done?
Well, yes, it suited its client.
Pardon?
It suited its client.
No, other than that.
Well, other than that, it assisted... The former customers of associates getting counsel.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I do think it doesn't sit very well with you to say, well, we want to emphasize these completely formal things, like Bowman as the purchaser should have hired a different law firm, because you don't want to emphasize the formal things when Bowman says, look, associates was not our client. We were actually collecting the debts for associates' subsidiaries. And associates trying to pierce its own corporate veil because the attorney-client relation is with associates' subsidiaries. And you say, well, fie on all the forms. Let's look at what really matters. And then when the shoe is on the other foot, you seem very formal.
Well, Your Honor, with respect to the attorney-client relationship, Indiana law says that you can infer an attorney-client relationship from the conduct of the parties. The conduct of the parties here was clear. Whoever owned those accounts...
I can understand that, but... Then what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, right? These debts were sold to a new entity that was a wholly owned subsidiary of this law firm or this law firm's partners. So you were selling it to the law firm and insisting on formal treatment as if you had sold these debts to Exxon Corporation, which then went out and hired Bowman to represent it, is not a plausible understanding of the economics of this transaction.
Well, Your Honor, let me just say this, that even if the court finds that the attorneys owed no duty to associates with respect to the American assignment claims, the fact remains that they did a great deal more to breach their duties.
I had no duties, so But what did they do that's bad? We'll cut through the legalisms.
Right.
What was the worst thing they did?
Well, they encouraged former customers of Associates to believe that those customers had claims against Associates on their loans.
And these were the customers whose debts had been sold, correct?
That's correct. That's correct. They assisted those customers in hiring legal counsel.
But that's part of their purchaser-seller dispute with Associates, isn't it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. In that situation, they weren't...
Was it independently tortious what they did, or just disloyal?
Independently tortious or just disloyal? Well, it was negligence. It was a violation of the standard of care.
Yeah. If you put that to one side, is it independently tortious? There's some suggestion, I think, in your brief that you view their dealings with True as independently tortious. Is that your view?
If by independently tortious you mean separate and apart from ethical duties, then yes.
Put the Indiana Rules of Professional Conduct in your pocket.
All right.
Was there a tort in their dealings with Troop? A tort committed on you?
Yes,
in their
legal malpractice, Your Honor, is the tort that was committed.
No, that's back to the ethical rules, because it's malpractice only through this ethical route.
I disagree, Your Honor. I mean,
you can disagree all you want, but if you want to answer my question, put that in your pocket and deal with the question whether there was an independent ethical violation.
Well, Your Honor, the standard of care in Indiana is established by case law, Bell versus Clark, and by the expert.
Look, are you willing to answer my question or not?
I'm not sure I understand your question. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You're not.
Forget
tracking.
About the ethical rules of Indiana. Assume that the defendant, that this law firm, never represented Associates.
All right.
It now does what it does, including sponsoring the Troop litigation. Has it committed a tort against your client?
If it has no attorney-client relationship with Associates, Your Honor, it has not.
Okay.
I'm afraid I've gotten off track. Let me say that separate from encouraging, assisting, and asserting claims, Your Honor, the attorneys also provided false and misleading testimony against their client at a default judgment hearing, resulting in a $500,000 default judgment. All of this without notice to Associates.
Well, that's one reason why the two of us ask these questions, right? You're effectively accusing them of suborning perjury. That's tortious independent of a former lawyer-client relation. But I just understood your answer as saying you're not making any such contention.
We're not certainly not bringing this action on suborning perjury, Your Honor. That's for sure. I see that my light's on. I will reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Maybe before you sit down, you could just clarify, what is the affiliate relationship, Associates and its affiliates? Are these wholly owned subsidiaries or some other sort of?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. So, Mr. Hull.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I am Andy Hull, counsel for the Bowman Firm. This appeal involves a legal malpractice claim wherein Associates seeks to recover from the firm and from Mr. Vishen millions of dollars in attorney's fees Associates incurred.
Who is Mr. Patton?
Mr. Patton is co-counsel with me, Your Honor, who has reserved 6 minutes of our time to address the law firm's counterclaims and the cross-appeal.
We have separate representation of the counterclaim and the...
We do, Your Honor. We do, Your Honor. It was that way in the court below and the law firm.
Is there a reason for that? It sounds unusual.
The law firm itself made a decision, I think perhaps in part due to insurance coverage issues, to hire separate counsel to prosecute its counterclaims and the cross-appeal in this case.
Mm-hmm. I think we actually have a rule against this, that only one lawyer will represent a given client without permission of the court, which I don't think you've asked for.
We were certainly in communication several times with the clerk, Your Honor, about this division of minutes and talked to a number of people in the clerk's office. I was not aware that we needed to make a formal motion We did file blue cards with the clerk's office on that point, indicating the division of time. The essence of Associates' claim is that its alleged lawyers exposed.
Very odd. I mean, we've been hearing cases in which firms have liability insurance, you know, for the last 20-odd years, and never seen a situation in which an insurance company wanted to split the representation between the defense and the counterclaim.
It was not the decision of the insurance company, Your Honor. It was the decision of the Bowman firm to split the argument.
And what was the basis for it? What was the thinking?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that I can provide you information about that.
Okay, thanks.
The essence of Associates' claim is that its alleged lawyers exposed potential Associates' wrongdoing as to matters that were not confidential and as to matters that were not a part of the attorney-client relationship. There are three independent alternative grounds upon which the district court's summary judgment motion can be affirmed. First, the firm's alleged conduct was not the proximate cause of Associates incurring attorney's fees. Second, the firm did not breach any professional duty.
And what do you mean by proximate cause?
Well, Your Honor, to be specific, I think there are a couple of reasons why there was no showing of proximate cause in this case.
I just asked you what you understand the term proximate cause to mean.
Well, by that I mean to say that the alleged conduct of the firm was not the but-for cause.
Yeah, well, that's not proximate cause. That's just cause.
In addition, Your Honor, I think that, and so if you look at what it is that Associates knew and Associates did, and if you look at what third parties knew, both the Gilliams, Mr. Troop, and the American Assignment Company, the purchaser of the sold accounts, you will see that the knowledge of those entities, the actions of those entities, lead to the result of the litigation being filed against Associates in the Gilliam case and the Troop case.
So are you saying if Vissian hadn't testified, is that how you pronounce his name?
Vissian, Your Honor.
If Vissian hadn't testified, Gilliam would still have gotten that default judgment? Is that the idea?
Well, I think there's every reason to think so, Your Honor. Associates had not appeared in that case, and there was a default hearing where Mr. Gilliam was free to offer whatever testimony he and his counsel saw fit. I would add on the issue of that testimony that the doctrine of absolute immunity should apply to Mr. Vissian with respect to that which he testified about at the default hearing.
I don't understand that.
Well, Mr. Vissian was testifying under subpoena. He was compelled to testify at that hearing.
What's your idea? Witnesses have absolute immunity. Witnesses can't be prosecuted for perjury? Is that your proposition?
I do not believe that they have civil liability, Your Honor, under Indiana law, nor do I think that Indiana law would allow an inquiry even to the motives of a witness testifying in a civil case. So I do not believe that Mr. Vissian or the firm faced any civil exposure relating to that testimony at the default hearing.
I find that hard to believe. I mean, I understand, you know, you're supposed to not, you can't use a pleading or testimony as evidence of defamation, but surely, you know, perjurious testimony could be part of a civil action. Of course it can be.
Your Honor, staying on that point, your question of proximate cause, I believe that there is a second reason why there is an absence of proximate cause in this case, and it goes to the court's analysis in the Outboard Marine case that is cited in our brief. In that case, this court recognized that a party has no legally protected interest to be free from discovery or accountability for its own conduct. And I do believe that that principle is applicable in this case. As in Outboard Marine, Associates was sued to account for its own conduct. That's all that those lawsuits presented, the Gilliam and the Troop case. The basis for those claims was known or learned by the sold account debtors and by the purchasers of the sold account, American Assignments. This court should not sanction Associates' attempt to complain that it was required to account for its own actions. As a second ground for affirming the district court opinion, we would argue that the firm breached no duty to Associates. It is undisputed, and the court's questionings reflect an understanding of this, the firm competently handled the collection matters that were referred to it. There's no contention that the firm divulged client confidences. Indeed, this dispute really boils over the issue of sold account information, that which belonged to American Assignments, that which American Assignments was privileged to use to defend itself, to prosecute claims, and information learned by the sold account debtors as they became aggrieved in the litigation that was caused by American Assignments' anticipated collection activities.
Isn't it a violation of the Indiana ethical rules for the firm to represent a new client against an existing client, even in an unrelated matter?
There is certainly an ethical question of whether a violation of Rule 1.7 exists when a law firm represents a client and at the same time is in a relationship representing another client adverse in litigation to that first client.
And can that constitute the basis for a malpractice claim?
No, we do not believe it can.
Under any circumstances?
Under any circumstances.
What about the Bell case?
The Bell case is a case, I think, that gives no discussion whatsoever to this Rule 1.7. What it is, however, is a duty of loyalty case. There's no question that in the attorney-client relationship there is a fundamental duty of loyalty. That comes from agency principles, and it is fashioned around the scope of the agency relationship. In Bell v. Clark, what was clear about that case, and I think compelling about that case, is that the lawyer was, in effect, general counsel for the limited partnership. The lawyer created the prospectus. The lawyer drafted the partnership agreement. The lawyer drafted other documents. The lawyer served as counsel on a continuing basis for both the law for both the limited partnership as well as its general partner. That lawyer in that case engaged in conduct which directly harmed the general partner as well as the partnership itself, fully within the scope of the engagement. I see that I am out of time. Just very quickly, as a third ground for affirming the district court, this court can rule, and we had asked the court to rule, that the firm owed no duty to Associates, that what was not established in this case was that Associates itself had a basis for claiming an attorney-client relationship with the law firm. There was no showing of a parent-subsidiary relationship. There was no showing that Associates itself owned the accounts, the collection accounts.
You say no showing of a... Your opponent said that these are wholly owned subsidiaries. Is that not true? Or?
Certainly that argument was asserted by Associates in response to the firm's assertion that there was no showing that
right.
Associates...
Right, so are they or are they not?
We don't know whether it's true or not, Your Honor, in our argument...
Do you have any reason to doubt that it is true?
I have no factual basis.
So we have to assume it's true in the procedural posture of the case. So if they're wholly owned subsidiaries, how hard are you going to press this distinction?
Our only point on that, Your Honor, is this, that it was an argument raised by Associates as a way to try to describe the existence of the attorney-client relationship. We think it was incumbent upon Associates to put forth the facts demonstrating that parent-subsidiary relationship and the ownership of the account by the subsidiary to, in fact, construct the attorney-client relationship.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Hall.
Thank
Mr.
you very
Patton.
Much.
May it please the court. For its cross appeal, the firm has three arguments. First, a sued party has standing to raise abuse of process. Second, abuse of process qualifies as illegal conduct for tortious interference with the business relations. And third, Associates Vice President and Associate General Counsel slandered the firm by calling firm clients and saying that the firm was bad and unethical. These and the other counterclaims show that
Let me tell you what my principal thought is when hearing these. I can understand your defense to Associates' charge, which is that these kinds of disputes should be worked out in the marketplace for legal services. They aren't the basis of litigation. If your firm is good or bad or indifferent, we'll work this out in the market. So dismiss the suit. Then, of course, you turn around and file your countersuit saying, let's actually not work it out in the market. Let's work it out through litigation. And if you're right, I don't understand why they're not right. We will figure out whether this firm's behavior was appropriate or not through litigation, and whether it was appropriate or not, the loser pays the winner. But I don't see how this can be one-sided.
Your Honor.
Which is what the burden of your current argument is.
Your Honor.
You have the two law firms, right? So
Your Honor, what I would point out is that if this had only been, for instance, it could be worked out in the marketplace, that would have been fine for the law firm. But when Associates went the next step of using this lawsuit to try to end and destroy my client's business, that's where it went.
No, what you describe as trying to end and destroy your client's business is that they let Ford Motor Company know what your client had done and suggested that this implied that they were not altogether faithful agents, which I must say that's exactly what these facts suggest, because your law firm is not altogether faithful agents. And Ford stewed about that for a while and then decided what business decision to make in light of it.
Yes, and as...
That is what it means to work something out in the market.
And what Ford did, though, was to withhold work from the firm. For example, here in Illinois, Bowman Hines had about 50% of the work, and under the Ford Challenge Grant, it would have received 75% but for this complaint and the telephone calls from an associate general counsel to the client itself.
Well, let me ask you, what statements were of defamatory and false that you rely on?
Well, what Associates said was that Bowman Hines did not notify Associates of the Gilliam default hearing, which was incorrect, that they then used that testimony and used that against them. And they basically, if you read
now, what's the false statement?
The false statement is that Bowman Hines is bad, unethical, and
well,
has...
No, that's opinion. That's
opinions,
not defamatory.
What is a
false statement of fact?
The false statement of fact is the first paragraph of the complaint contains a list of all the things that that Associates said the firm did.
I just want a false statement of fact.
Well, calling a firm bad?
No, that's an opinion. That's
okay.
Not actionable.
Well, when, for instance, they filed the lawsuit and they sent the complaint to the firm's clients, and then they call the firm's clients.
And that's
what
absolutely privileged.
What is the
false
statement?
Why don't you give us a false statement of fact?
Not contained in a pleading.
What?
Could be repeated outside the pleading, of course, but what would it be?
Well, the false statements are the first paragraph of the complaint, Your Honor. I see that my time
would
is up.
Would you give
repeated?
Me a false statement instead of referring to the complaint?
I think I referred to the ones that jumped to the top of my mind. You're saying that these are opinions, but...
Yes.
Here's the difference, is when an opinion goes beyond... For instance, they cite a case that said that when you call somebody a crank, that is an opinion. This court's decision. But what the person defined crank as in that case is it didn't go to character and reputation. It specifically distinguished out that. And when you start talking about a law firm's character and reputation, under Indiana law, calling a lawyer a shyster is defamation per se.
Well, did they call Bowman a shyster or Vichian a shyster?
In effect, yes.
In effect?
What did they say?
Well, Your Honor, I see that my time is up.
Answer my question.
What they said was that for instance, John Feetz called Roseanne Frank and John Godfrey of Ford, and they specifically said they were bad, unethical, and that you should not use them as a lawyer. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Patton. Mr. Shockley? How much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Your Honor, on the cross-appeal, you should read very carefully the testimony of the witnesses whom they point to for their allegations of defamation. The witness that was just referred to specifically said in her deposition, I don't remember if he used the word bad. I don't remember if he used the word unethical. Even if those were defamatory words, there's no evidence that they were spoken. If I may return, I'm going to take one more.
Well, what about abusive process? Why isn't that a tenable theory of the counterclaim?
Well, abusive process requires both an improper use of process and an ulterior purpose. The improper use of process requires a misuse of the judicial machinery. There's no evidence of that. Associates filed its complaint, prosecuted to its authorized end. The fact that summary judgment was entered shouldn't be.
But if you hawk around this complaint and try to get other lawyers to fire the law firm that you have a dispute with, why isn't that a misuse of legal process?
It might be, Your Honor, but there is no evidence that Associates was responsible for the mailing of the complaint to the Bowman Hines
clients. I don't agree with that. Your general counsel called up Ford, didn't it?
He called up.
Following up on what this fellow Bond?
Borns.
So Bond works for the law firm you hired. And now, didn't he?
Clarence Borns, Your Honor?
Yes.
Did not work for Bowman Hines, no. He was an attorney, a former partner of Bowman Hines, and at the time that the complaints were mailed around, a competitor of Bowman Hines for collection business. The evidence is that he
sent. He was. You don't represent Bowman Hines.
No, Your Honor.
Well, didn't you use Bond's law firm to help you in your dispute with Bowman Hines?
No, Your Honor, absolutely not.
Well, what was Bond doing going around bad-mouthing Bowman Hines?
He was a former partner of Bowman Hines who was engaged in litigation as a result of his departure.
You had no relationship with Bond?
Clarence Borns was.
Borns, whatever.
I'm sorry. Clarence Borns collected.
Did you have a relationship with Borns?
Associates used Borns to collect debt in completely unrelated matters.
Fine. It's really pulling teeth. Now, what? Now, your general counsel, what's his name? Begins with F?
John Feetz.
Well, didn't he follow up Bond's contact with Ford with his own call?
What he followed up was the service of the counterclaim on Associates, alleging that Ford had received the complaint and that Bowman Hines had been damaged as a result. It was an investigation of the counterclaim, Your Honor.
Investigation?
Yes.
He called up Ford and said what?
And said, I've received a copy of the counterclaim. I'd like to talk to you about it. He spoke to John Godfrey, an in-house counsel at Ford, who referred him to Roseanne Frank, a paralegal there.
And why did he want to talk to him about it?
Because the counterclaim alleged that Ford had received a copy of the malpractice complaint and that Bowman Hines had been damaged as a result. And so he was following up the counterclaim. Borns was not the agent of Associates in mailing the complaint to Ford.
Why not? Borns was working for the firm that was working for
you. Well, that goes to the issue of inherent authority, and inherent authority is limited to the scope of the matter in which the attorney is retained. Completely unrelated collection.
That's
matters.
Not what you're saying in your malpractice action, where you're saying that they owed you a duty of loyalty from the moment they woke up in the morning until the instant they fell asleep, in every respect, whether they were representing you or not.
Yes, Your Honor. A different point than inherent authority, where the issue is, can you bind the principal with your conduct? I see I'm out of time, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Well, wait a second.
I'm sorry.
You wanted to say something about the main claim.
Excuse me?
You wanted to say something about the main claim, didn't you?
The main claim? Yes, I did, Your Honor. The Bell case holds that action adverse to a client's interest can be malpractice because it's the failure to exercise the care and skill ordinarily exercised by attorneys. The misconduct of the attorneys in this case was not limited to their representation of American Assignment, the debt company, but to their assistance and encouragement of other claims by other people against associates. The approximate result? I'm sorry. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much to all counsel. Next case for argument.